I want to tell you today about TV gamma ray observations and their applications for galactic accelerators. And in fact, I'm going to limit myself to two classes of galactic TV sources, pulsar wind nebulae and shell-type supernova remnants. There are also at least four binary systems in the galaxy which emit TV gamma rays. I won't talk about those. And I also won't have time to tell you about some other interesting and unusual objects like super bubbles and forbidden velocity rings. But Don suggested I try to keep it to a smaller number of topics and have enough discussion about them. So I'll discuss first pulsar wind nebulae. Well, first I'll remind you how we detect TV gamma rays and what the sky looks like in TV gamma rays. And then I'll discuss in a bit of detail the pulsar wind nebula, because they're the most numerous class of galactic sources of TV gamma rays, the two classes, main classes in which they fall, and some general statements about the population and what we can infer from the observations. And then I'll discuss in a bit more detail the shell-type supernova remnants, starting with historical supernova remnants and the so-called TV shells, and then one heading is missing here, but that's the supernova remnants which are interacting with molecular cloud, which I'll also discuss in some detail. So TV gamma ray, or very high energy gamma ray astronomy, is the energy range of a few tens of GeV to 100 GeV. This is limited simply by the collecting area. We do this from the ground. GeV gamma rays are so-called are detected by satellites, but eventually you run out. The upper energy bound of Fermi is set by two things. One is the collecting area, so fluxes are too low to be detectable, and also the calorimeter depth, and basically their glass Fermi is the biggest thing that we could put into space for some time to come, so it's unlikely that we can do much more from space in the foreseeable future. So for higher energies, we use the Earth's atmosphere as a detector, and we look with telescopes such as these at the night sky on dark moonless nights to see the chunk of light from showers which develop in the atmosphere. This technique, the so-called imaging atmospheric dark Cherenkov technique, is the one that's been most successful with a number of experiments working at the present time. MAGIC on the Canary Islands, Veritas, not too far from here, Kangaroo in Australia, and HESS in Namibia, which is depicted here. The general principle is similar, but the details vary. Here we have four telescopes of 12-meter diameters, fast cameras, which take images of a few nanoseconds exposure, which is the duration of these pulses of chunk of light from these showers, observing on dark moonless nights. So just a couple of slides to remind you how we do this. The biggest problem is that the overall flux is completely dominated by charged particles, and the biggest problem we have is to discriminate between gamma rays and charged particles, and the way this is done is using this imaging capability. We can tell the difference between a shower which is an purely electromagnetic shower, which is very regular, which is very narrow, and a hadronic shower, which is initiated by hadronic interactions, which have more transverse momentum, and therefore a shower is more irregular. And this is one of the main criteria for background discrimination.
Do you get useful cosmic ray data?
Say again?
Do you get useful cosmic ray data?
It's difficult because the energy reconstruction can be done reasonably well for gamma rays. It's harder for hadronic showers because there are more fluctuations. There is one thing that can be done, which has been done with iron. In principle, one difference is that here you see no Cherenkov light up to the first interaction. That's a gamma ray. Here you can, in principle, see Cherenkov light from the primary if it's a charged particle. This is very difficult except for the highest charges, and it has been done for iron to look in the reconstruction of these showers for the tiny signal from the primary chunk of light, and this allows to estimate some flux of iron, which is compatible with what we know from other measurements. It's not more precise, but at least it's some handle on the charged cosmic rays. Yes.
How do you discriminate from like leptonic showers, like electrons or
gluons? You don't. the other thing you do, so this is to try to get rid of most of your background, then you're still left with, in principle, diffuse electrons, for example. There are a small percentage of these hadrons which looks like gamma rays, so you can't reject 100%. And then the other thing that's done is simply imaging, that is reconstructing the position of these gamma rays on the sky and making background subtraction from, there are different methods to estimate the background, the diffuse background in your field of view, and to extract signal from sources from this.
That side view of the shower, was that an actual image of a real shower?
They may be simulated, but anyway, this is very much what it looks like. And in reality, you also have fluctuations from. This is a view in the camera of a shower which starts, which is originated in the center of the field of view. But here you have the same thing illustrated. But we looked at these images in stereo, and one purpose of this is that from the axes of the shower images, where they meet is telling you the direction of origin of the source in the sky of the gamma ray, because it's a vertical shower, and depending on you can, in other words, you can reconstruct gamma rays from different directions in the field of view. With as we have a 5-degree field of view diameter, magic is a little bit less. Magic is quite a bit less. Fairy dust is a little bit less. One purpose is to reconstruct the direction of origin of the gamma ray in the sky. The other is to reconstruct where the foot point of the gamma of the shower is. And this, in combination with how much light you see in each image, gives you energy reconstruction of the shower. So depending on where the gamma ray is falling and how much light it's giving you, you can estimate the energy, direction, energy. And the stereo views also improve the discrimination. That is, you can have a hadronic shower that will look like gamma ray from one direction, but not from another. So you have a bit more power of background discrimination.
Was magic just one dish?
Magic initially was a different concept, which was one very big mirror. This improves your signal to noise in the image, but it doesn't give you some of the advantages of stereo. Now, with Magic 2, they have a second one, which in principle gives some of the advantages of, gives the advantages of stereo, although your collecting area is better if you have three or more. The next phase of HESS is currently being built, is a big telescope in the middle of the four to try to get some of the advantages of the larger collecting rate. So there are advantages to both aspects. Any more questions about TV techniques before I start looking at results? So just to remind you, for the longest time, the only galactic source detected in this field was the Crab Nebula, and then there were a couple of AGN. So this has been the standard candle of TV gamma ray astronomy. The idea is that one sees synchrotron emission from this object in most of the electromagnetic spectrum, radio, optical, infrared, X-ray, gamma, GEV gamma rays. Although over here you can start getting dominated by the pulsar. This is purely the nebular emission with the pulsar subtracted. Then at very high energy or TeV gamma rays, what you see is inverse Compton from the same electrons, inverse Compton on the cosmic microwave background, infrared photons, and in the case of the Crab, the synchrotron photons themselves are so intense that they provide a significant target for inverse Compton scattering.
Even when the pulsar is subtracted, it's not assuming there's no one pulse flux?
These are the points over here. I'm sure we'll get much better results from Fermi, but this is the Crab is a point source to EGRET, and it will be to Fermi as well, and also to TeV gamma rays. So if there is a truly point-like component from the pulsar, which is steady, you won't be able to discriminate it from the nebula and gamma rays. So There are a large number of other pulsar wind nebulae known, but most of them were so far only detected in the radio and X-rays, a few of them in the optical, until recently, where we started seeing them in TV gamma rays. So one of the, with the current generation of TV gamma ray instruments, and in particular with HESS, which is looking at the central regions of the galaxy, we've been able to detect a large number of galactic sources. This is not quite up to date, but anyway, a fair idea of the status of the HESS galactic plane survey from around plus 60 degrees up to minus 80 degrees in the central regions of the galaxy. There are probably a bit more now than 50 galactic TV sources known, and about half of these, if you're a bit generous, are either pulsar wind nebulae or candidate pulsar wind nebulae. So we have, these can be classified in two main categories. We have the relatively long ones, like the Crab. Most of these are found in so-called composite supernova remnants. That is, you have a young pulsar, which is born in the center of a supernova explosion. You have a pulsar wind nebulae around this pulsar, and you can see the shell of the original explosion. Typically, these are relatively symmetric. You have the pulsar in G0.9, G21.5, K75.
Right? TV or radio?
Vila?
No, you said you can see the shell of the supernova remnant.
That's right. I'm sorry, I should have shown a better example. But anyway, the contours over here are X-rays, and what you see is a central region which shows non-thermal X-ray emission, that's synchrotron emission from the pulsar wind nebula, and you see a shell of emission which is typically thermal and in several cases also with some non-thermal contribution and X-rays. You see something similar in the radio, where typically you see a synchrotron emission from both the Clarion and from the shell with slightly, with somewhat different spectral indices. Clarion is fatter. So these objects are all detected by HESS. This is MSH15-52, is the nebula of pulsar B1509, which is over here at the center. It was the first case where all of these are unresolved point sources. This is a case where we can actually see the extension of the pulsar wind nebula. What's interesting is that previously what we had was synchrotron emission, so that's a convolution of the distribution of energetic particles, which are assumed to be electrons in this scenario, and the magnetic field. So you couldn't really tell whether this region was, the only reason you had this elongation was that the B field was higher in this jet-like morphology, and particles were all over, or it was really a concentration of particles. Now, with inverse Compton, the idea is that the targets for this are relatively uniform. They are the CMB, which is bathing all the galaxy with uniform density, the far infrared background, which is has some variation, but nonetheless is relatively uniform over the scale of a remnant like this. So what you're seeing is really the distribution of the charge of the energetic particles, without any convolution by magnetic field or anything else. And that tells you that in this object, typically you're used to seeing like the Crab tori with somewhat a fainter jet. In this object, the most of the particles are along a direction which is probably along the rotation axis of the pulsar, although it's not a jet in the usual sense of the term. It really is most likely a subsonic.
How can you rule out synchrotron self-constant?
How can I rule out that it's a
synchrotron self-constant?
Simply, you calculate the energy density of the synchrotron photons, which you see, and the angular size. And except in the case of the Crab, this is a much smaller energy density than the CMB and also a far infrared background. I haven't gone through the calculation for every one of them, but I think in general this is the case. The Crab is quite exceptionally intense in terms of photon density. If it was synchrotron self-constant, then you would be right. Then you still had a convolution of something that's spatially non-homogeneous.
quite confusing to sort out what magnetic field is if you really had that.
Again?
If you really had that, if it's in some Compton cases, in a detailed map, you can sort out what the field is because ratio and the intensities gets.
Yeah, you might still be able to disentangle it, but it would be much more complicated.
I know it's tricky.
I mean, where it's tricky, but it can be done.
In any case, it's not relevant for most of these things.
So we had a number of these young, relatively young pulsar wind nebula. Then we have another category, which we call offset pulsar wind nebulae, of which Vela is a prototype. And in fact, these are the Rosette contours. What you see in X-rays is you see the pulsar, you see a very bright but relatively compact nebula around the pulsar, which is, this is a zoom of this region, and this is a zoom of this region. It looks like this inner part, which is presumably the wind termination shock, shows something like a torus, Doppler-boosted torus. But over very large scales, what you see is a region of X-ray emission and radio emission, which is even slightly larger. And the TEV emission correlates with this, and not with the compact pulsar wind nebula. One in the leptonic interpretation, what this means is that presumably the magnetic field is significantly higher over here. This is why it sticks out in synchrotron, but it doesn't stick out in TV gamma rays. And you see the distribution of high energy electrons, which is shifted in one direction from the pulsar. The explanation that's been suggested for this, and also for the fact that the radio pulsar wind nebula of Vela has the same feature, that it's displaced from the pulsar in one direction only. One explanation that's been around in the literature for quite some time is that as you get to older phases in the composite supernova remnant evolution, the reverse shock of the host SNR hits the pulsar wind nebula at the center. And if the SNR is expanding in a non-homogeneous medium, it will hit on one side much before the other side. And the interpretation here is that in the very large Vela shell supernova remnant, this region is encountering a denser medium. The reverse shock has hit on this side first and displaced the pulsar wind nebula in the opposite direction.
Can you do something with the peak? What's the cooling time of that?
The idea is that it depends on the B field, but for B fields of around 10 microgauss or so, the X-rays that you see are from electrons which are much higher energy, well, somewhat higher energy than the ones that you see in inverse Compton. And so these have relatively short lifetimes, and these that you see in TV gamma rays have much longer lifetimes. And so this explains also why can explain why you see the X-ray much more concentrated near the pulsar and the TV much more extended.
But I think for this pulsar, the promotion is not coming. So your question is it a sort of a trailing, and I'm not sure in which direction it's going. Maybe
tomorrow. The proper motion is actually is in this direction, so okay. More or less. Yeah, this would be another option, but I think, first of all, the velocities are typically not quite high enough. And in this case, at least, and then possibly in some other cases, I'm not sure how many have measured proper motions, but it's not in the right direction. Certainly in Vela, it isn't.
Does anybody understand why the compact nebula is so faint? This is a pretty powerful.
Everything is so faint in Vela. We have
pretty powerful pulsar.
E dot is quite large, and where does this energy go is a big question. It's in terms of X-ray efficiency, it's very low. In terms of TEV efficiency, it's also very low. Unlike the Crab, which is relatively low in TEV efficiency, but that's because the B field is high, and so it's more efficient than synchrotron. It's really not clear where the energy in Vela goes.
And well, it's so much low because actually there's relations between pulse spin down power and X-ray luminosity, and
yeah.
Usually it's within a factor of 1,000 or so. I mean, that's sort of the scatter there. So is this an unusual pulsar in that sense?
So this is a relation.
This is a big problem.
We always
I have these plots further down, and I'm not sure if I can identify Vela on it. Maybe we can have a look at it two or three slides from now.
I'm saying this because, to some extent, of course, what you see in the fossil wind nebula tells you something about the spin down power in the past, right? So if you see a large amount of energy in the trailing part and a very small amount of energy in the compact nebula, that means that in the past it was probably much more powerful.
Yes, I'll get to that. But even in terms of TV luminosity, it's less efficient than the typical number. One suggestion that's been around is that maybe some of the large fraction of the wind power in Vela goes into ions, and this is that what you could see might be, in fact, hadronic emission. I won't discuss that in much detail. In Vela, I'm not quite sure, but in general, this is difficult to do. That is, you don't have enough ions being produced, and the Galois-Julian density times the ejecta that are around, it's hard to make these kinds of flux, TV fluxes from that. There are a couple other sources, and the so-called Kookaburra that look like this. And one interesting object, which I'll spend a couple of slides on, is a source where we see only the TV emission, that is, this is the Hess image of this source, which has well-known pulsar at the edge. A pulsar has enough spin-down luminosity to power all this, but there is nothing else in radio or X-rays that has this kind of extent. The only thing is a small compact nebula in X-rays, which is in this small region over here, which is trailing in the same direction, more or less. Now, if you think of the picture I just showed you of Vela, where you have a compact nebula that's quite bright and some more diffuse extended emission, if you put it farther away, you will be able to detect this, but not any X-ray, diffuse X-ray emission that might be coincident with this. So the idea is that this is potentially a Vela-like object, but the proof in this particular case, or at least the strong indication we have that that's the case, is that in this object we see spectral index variations in the TV gamma rays as a function of distance brought to pulsar. That is, spectrum is steepening, the TV spectrum is steepening away from the pulsar. Another way of showing this is that this is the high energy image, and as you get to lower and lower energy, nebula becomes bigger. You typically see this kind of thing in X-rays. Almost all pulsar wind nebulae show this. Well, many of pulsar wind nebulae show this. And it's explained simply as aging of the electron population. As you get further away from the pulsar where the acceleration is going on, or the pulsar wind termination shot, for example. It's the first and the clearest cut case where we see this also in the population of TV emitting electrons. Because it's an older object, so the synchrotron, the last time for these electrons becomes sufficient that you can see this kind of effect as well. And also you have enough statistics, which is not trivial. This is a relatively bright source.
Can I ask you a question? It's a bit of in the US, when one models, when experts model baryonic nebula, do they, you know, what are key dimensionless parameters, the thickness of the whole nebula as compared to the radius of the termination shaft? And has that been modeled quantitatively? For example, can you estimate the cooling fraction energy that's dissipated based on that geometry?
Well, so first of all, your very first comment, it's true that in models, at least in simple models, the fraction of the radius that's occupied by the pulsar wind nebula tells you something about the energy injected in the pulsar wind nebula compared to 10 to the 51 ergs, for example, which is the energy in the blast wave. It becomes more complicated to do things when you're in these kinds of offset pulsar wind nebulae, where presumably the reverse shock has hit and it's an asymmetric reverse shock. And I'm not aware of very detailed recent simulations of this.
A lot's been done, in a sense, faking by doing the reverse shock phase and still treating as if it's spherically symmetric. that lets you get out.
Assuming it's spherically symmetric here with low, yeah, medium density, and
the
here with a.
Yeah. I've seen are tenders with the pulsar back in the middle still. And that lets you get at questions like, is the thing, is clockwork, you're getting adiabatic compression of the particles, which is important to the discrete energy content. There have been some models that look at the offset, but that, I've seen one where they actually did the, made a synthetic map, following the aging of the particles in some detail. That's been done in quite a bit of detail for the crab, which of course doesn't show this phenomenon, including the multidimensional structure of the MHD flows.
Question is the cooling of dynamical significance shows anybody?
Mostly, well, the ones where people know, understand thoroughly is the crab, but mostly not. That is the particles that are doing the aging that you see in the X-rays and the optic will contribute a small, relatively small fraction of the pressure. It's the usual phenomenon of the synchrotron radiation. It's the higher energy particles are much more radially efficient than the low energy. So you get everything you see.
Fraction of the energy.
You get everything you see with a small fraction of the energy in the particles.
But if you have very flat spectrum, it's not much of the energy in the electrons, any energy of the electrons.
Well, the spectrum in the crab is broken.
Yeah, so that makes it more.
So it's the energy. Energy is, if you want to be naive about it, the pressure is mainly contributed by particles with energy of around 10 to the 3 to 10 to the 4 mc squared, and that they're not. They don't lose a lot of energy radiatively. Well, what goes to break? Come by on Monday, Tuesday. There'll be an interesting local debate about where is the break and what is it. There is one break. One break is caused by cooling, and their canonical wisdom is the break happens at this energy of a few 10 to the 4th mc squared. And shows up in the spectrum.
It would be on the other break, otherwise.
And that says there's a high energy break, and then that says that's intrinsic to the acceleration mechanism. There's a more recent campaign by Pasquale's colleagues, actually. The break is the intrinsic break is in the X is the low energy one, and the cooling break is up in seeing steepening from optical to X-ray. And this is really based more on these more complete dynamical models.
Anyway, this is for the case of the crab, but more generally, what you say has been done in some, at least some relatively detailed attempts in the spherically symmetric case, but not in these asymmetric cases, where there's still a topic of current research, I think. And the simulation.
It's a significant issue. I mean, if you say that the accelerator has to produce a broken spectrum, that's an interesting.
Yes, but the idea is that when the reverse shock hits, then you get further strange kinks and wiggles in the spectrum, which may explain some of these other objects which have spectra that don't quite look like the crabs. Anyway, I want to talk also about shells, so let me try to wrap up what I want to say about pulsar wind nebulae. There's these objects like these are currently still being detected. There's a pure pylon recently detected, announced less than a month ago by Veritas, another one composite by Hirth, a nebula around this pulsar, which both of these may actually have some component of shell pulsar wind nebula as well. We have another example which looks like it might be similar to 1825, which I just showed you, where you see some spectral evolution in the TeV gamma rays. If you try to look at the luminosities of these objects in TeV gamma ray, so you need to know the distance. In the case where you have a pulsar in the radio, you can estimate the distance from the dispersion measure of the pulsar and it's a model of the electron distribution in the galaxy, which gives you at least a somewhat more precise number of whether it's actually accurate and whether the systematics in this is another question. But anyway, you're in a slightly better situation than with SNRs where you have pure shell SNRs where you have more factors that enter into the uncertainty on the distance. So if you try to do this, median luminosity is something like the Crabs, around 10 to the 35 ergs in this energy band, which is roughly representative of what we can observe typically in TV gamma rays. And we have a number of candidates, that is, sources which have a pulsar which is powerful enough, but is typically not at the center of the source, but it's relative. It's a offset like beta like source where you have the pulsar at one end and diffusing TV emission away from it. And if you add these candidates over here, they tend to fall around the same luminosities as the ones that you know are real pulsar nebulae. So it's an additional indication that most of these candidates might actually be real pulsar nebulae.
Presumably, the lack of low luminosity ones is ascribable to sensitivity cutoffs.
Yes, I think. I mean, over here are sources that are, in this case, that's. I think they are somewhat further away, but I'm not sure if that's really true. That's K75 and G21.5. Over here is Vela. So Vela is really underluminous, also in TV gamma rays. And there we know the distance is quite close.
It's actually nearby.
It's nice and nearby.
It's nearby. That's another way of saying it. But it's nearby. In principle, we think we can see all of it. And still, the total flux is luminosity is quite low.
We have about a factor 20 in dynamic range of flux.
Something I didn't mention. We now have additional data on Vela. We see TV emission all the way to the edges, more or less, of the radio baryon, and you don't expect to see any further than that. So we think we have all the flux, TV flux from Vela, and it's only giving this luminosity. You wouldn't see Vela if it was further away.
Little dynamic range flux.
Yes. The question is can there be instead of having this cutoff in the population that's having a low luminosity, could there be a large number that are just too faint?
I'm not saying that this is intrinsic.
The question is about is legitimate. Why are they faint?
Of course,
But anyway, the tip of the distribution is around 10 to the 35 ergs per second.
It's back to that question.
And this you would probably see, and at least in the regions which we've looked at relatively deeply all the way across the galaxy.
So do you have a plot, this LTV versus the spin down panel?
Next slide, thank you. So
you were bribed.
This is the plot that you were telling about. This is a spin down luminosity in all three plots, and this is the X-ray nebula luminosity, and this traces quite well. It's not a direct proportionality, but anyway, it's a very relatively narrow relationship around the spin-down luminosity. That's saying that the X-ray nebula is recently accelerated electrons, and so it's proportional to the power injected by the pulsar. There are something like six decades over here, and two or three decades over here. It's a quite steep dependence. TV luminosity is essentially shows no particular trend versus C dot. I think this is Vela. So, and therefore, if this is Vela over here, it must be this one over here. It's also under luminescent X-rays. That's the answer to your question.
So, I mean, as you say, the X-rays is something that has recently been done. TV is sort of what was the initial spin luminosity?
The idea is in TV gamma rays, you're seeing electrons, the accumulation of electrons since the birth of the pulsar, and therefore something that's roughly proportional to the initial rotational energy of the pulsar, or at least that's related to
the integral of current period. Is there some other evidence for that?
Yeah, one idea is indeed to try to use this to estimate initial birth periods of pulsars. There are assumptions that go into that, and you need to know a bit more about the spectrum. But nonetheless, the idea is that because in principle these electrons are around since the beginning of the since the birth of the pulsar. Same is true of the radio synchrotron emitting electrons. You can use knowledge of the spectrum to try to get an estimate for the average B field in nebula and then the energy and these electrons, and it gives you some estimates of the initial birth, at least the minimum or maximum initial birth period. That is, you have to have had at least this much energy initially in order to create all these electrons.
But the surprising thing is, on the one hand, it looks like TV remnants are are very faint. On the other hand, they sort of dominate the source population of
I think,
NASA.
These are...
Many of those were new. I mean, so radio is not the best way to find them, but TV seems to be the best way, although they are still faint.
There are now a number of cases where a new energetic pulsar has been found in a TV source, or a synchrotron nebula has been found in a TV source by looking deeper at specifically at TV sources. So this is already proven to be the case that it seems that TV sources are a good way to find energetic pulsars.
What about the opposite? How many normal young-looking beautiful PWMs don't have a TV?
Yeah, for this, there's work in progress to try to get upper limits on a statistically meaningful sample and to try to see. I think so. This is a caveat in some sense. Over here, I plot only the TV detected ones, and so this is a bias in the population, of course. And I think that there you will certainly find upper limits that are quite a bit lower than these. So the spread is bigger than it looks over here, because if you include upper limits, most likely it's still work in progress.
If you actually see a nice PWM X-rays, is there a reason why it shouldn't produce TV?
Good question. Let us get the upper limits and then we'll discuss that. if you take gamma ray luminosity over X-ray luminosity, you get a nice trend, but probably this is just the result of dividing something that's flat by something that has a nice correlation. So it's not clear that this is really very meaningful. But you can interpret it as saying, well, X-ray trace in the recently ejected and the TV trace the history. Which is still true.
PC58 makes that. Sort of an example that has a little confusing in that, because the X-rays, for example, don't age to get away from the pulsar.
Well, they do, but they do get all the way to the edge of the nebula, which is puzzling. I think you still get a steepening of the spectral index.
I'm not as much as expected. I'm saying it at all.
If it's really the remnant of SN10-1181, it's very puzzling, but most indications are that it's quite a bit older, in which case it might have been already hit by the reverse shock, and then maybe you can explain some of these effects, but it's it hasn't been done in detail. So we have a lot of these TV pulsar wind nebulae. We can get to about half of the non-source population. You have the young ones and the older offset ones. They tend to be the most, at least relatively luminous sources in the galactic plane. But what I want to talk about for the rest of the talk, and in fact for, I have more slides over here, are shell type supernova remnants. So this is interesting, of course, because we all think that there are good reasons to think that these are the sources of galactic cosmic rays. And there's observational evidence for electron acceleration, but the only direct observational evidence for proton acceleration would be through TeV gamma rays, that is, hadronic interactions of accelerated particles with ambient medium produced by zeros, which decay into two gamma rays, and which we can see. So this has been historically one of the drivers of TeV gamma ray astronomy. The big question is, how do you know that it's hadronic or leptonic? So I'm going to start by showing you, I'll try to go quickly, all the SNRs which we have detected, and then I'll discuss in some more detail what we can say about the nature of the emission. Starting with historical, or at least young, supernova remnants, Cassiopeia A has been detected by Hegra some time ago, and it's been confirmed by MAGIC and also by Veritas. It's unresolved. It's too compact, at least with Hegra and MAGIC, to resolve. But it has a spectrum which is somewhat steeper than you might expect, and a luminosity which is significantly smaller than the pulsar wind nebulae, which we've been discussing so far. On the question of leptonic versus hadronic, one point in Cassie is that it's thought that the magnetic field is really very high, and therefore it seems unlikely that you might see inverse Compton emission. The ratio of synchrotron to inverse Compton is such that the predicted inverse Compton would be very undetectable. So this is some argument in favor of hadronic emission to this.
There is a caveat. The high magnetic field estimate comes from Bremsstrahl electrons. So if you go back to Armin and Toyon's model,
okay,
you actually have that extent to very high energies.
Yeah, and the other thing that's
the only random way to do that.
The other thing that's puzzling is that, well, you can't resolve this in TeV, but at least not with these instruments. But the most of the non-thermal emission comes not from the outer shell, but in fact from an inner ring, which may be the reverse shock, or it may be non-thermal Bremsstrahlung going on there. So I think there's still some debate about gas A in particular, which we'll get discussed further. The next oldest shell-type supernova remnants, Tycho, has a relatively deep upper limit from Hegra. Kepler, which is in the southern hemisphere, has a comparatively deep limit from Hess. And essentially, both of these must be somewhat less luminous than Cass A. Otherwise, we would have seen them already, or Hegra would have seen them. I don't know if there's a deeper upper limit in progress from MAGIC or Veritas, but it would certainly be interesting.
For reference, what are the what's the energy content in radio emitting electrons? The minimum.
I'm not sure, but Cass A is certainly also much more luminous in radio than either Tycho or Kepler. Or
it's surprisingly more luminous. I think it's something like 1600 Jansky Cass A, and I think Tycho, which should have a similar magnetic field if you trust the magnetic field measurements at the edge. It's about 200 microgauss, but it is only 50 Jansky. So it must have lots of electrons. Yeah, it is the brightest.
Yeah.
Apart from if you go to higher energies, you go the red takes over, but low energies, it's and I'm not sure why it is so bright. It has many more electrons than any of the other.
I think the B field estimate is also higher in Cass A, but yes, it doesn't explain everything. Yeah.
It's a little bit higher, but maybe 500 versus.
But not in the ratio of the radio flux.
I'm starting to get this feeling that electron efficiency varies a lot from source to source, and that's of interest to theorists.
Cass A has a sort of peculiar dynamics thing as well. Well, and it may have been a much more powerful accelerator in the past, and all those electrons are still there.
Well, something happened. I mean, their age is not all that different. Something must be different.
So Cass A also, I think it loses its luminosity by 1% per year. And this is attributed to adiabatic expansion, which means basically that there are more electrons there than there are constantly being accelerated. I mean, so it tells you that in the past it was more efficient.
Cass A is younger than these. It's about 300 years old, and these are about 500. And it's also a question of the medium.
Tycho is 500 years. Kepler is, you know, it is. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so
the only one that has a very bright ring in the center, right? So that's also something that happened to them once.
And it's not clear also what the surrounding medium, what role the surrounding medium plays in this. But, so in these so-called historical, Cass A is a bit a special case. We know more or less the age. That doesn't mean that we know the size because we don't know the distance. For example, in Kepler, the real bounds that we have from H1 absorption still leaves something like a factor 2 uncertainty in luminosity. So I'll say a little bit more about that a bit later. I want to say a bit, talk a bit more detail about 1006. So this is a large dimethyl shell. So we can see resolve the emission here with Hess. There was, well, there's a complicated history, but anyway, the this is for a different audience. We believe that the flux is really this one. Where we see this is the Hess map, and the contours are XMM non-thermal emission smoothed to the resolution of Hess, and you can see that there is an excellent correlation between the TeV emission and the synchrotron emission. Now, so I should have said probably you know that the shell looks like this, and there is thermal emission which completes the circle, but the non-thermal emission comes from these two regions. 1006 is almost certainly, well, is a type 1A, was a type 1A supernova. So it had, it exploded, it didn't explode in a wind, which is the case for a core collapse supernova, which makes the evolution more complicated. Presumably this exploded in unperturbed interstellar medium. Also, it's quite high above the galactic plane, so there's every reason to think that it's exploding in a medium with fairly regular magnetic fields. This is interesting because it tells, this has the potential to tell you which magnetic field geometry is more efficient for particle acceleration. Also, from the X-rays, well, I'll say this a bit more about that in the next slide. Yeah, what I just wanted to say here is that by comparing the TeV flux with the synchrotron flux, you get a magnetic field, space averaged in one zone magnetic field, which is around 30 microgusts, which is low compared to what you expect from the narrowness of the X-ray rims. Hadronic scenario is just possible, but the spectrum over here, I didn't show it, is relatively steep, 2.4 spectral index again. And if you extrapolate that steep spectrum all the way down to 1 GeV, you have too much energy in cosmic rays. So the only way that you can do it is by saying that I extrapolate. This is a cutoff, and I extrapolate with the spectrum of 2. I'll show some other example of this a bit later. And the density around 1006 is also known observationally to vary relatively, so maybe by a factor of 4 at most. There's a region over here which is, seems to be encountering denser material. So whether you think it's inverse Compton on the CMB or you think it's hadronic, in both cases you are seeing the distribution of the accelerated particles with controlled with something that's relatively uniform. That's telling you that in those two regions, in projection at least, this is where the acceleration of these particles is going on. And you know from the X-rays that, in fact, you could imagine that this is a belt. Seen in projection, it's rim brightened, it's bright over here. But you can estimate how much X-rays you would see, non-thermal X-rays you would see in the middle part if that was true, and it's much less than this. And therefore, the conclusion is that it's really caps on the surface of this sphere that are bright in synchrotron. And these are also the regions that are bright in TV gamma rays, although I'm not sure if we can do the same exercise to show that it's really not compatible with the belt. But anyway, in synchrotron, they are caps, and they are, this is the region from which the particles are most efficiently accelerated. So if you think that this is exploding in a uniform magnetic field by symmetry, this is, these are the regions where the magnetic field, where you have parallel shocks.
What about radio polarization? Can you learn?
Say again?
What about radio polarization?
It's typically, it's difficult to get these things from radio polarization because the radio polarization is much less than you would expect from a regular field, and it's thought that it's dominated by all kinds of turbulent creation of the magnetic field. So if you could measure the polarization ahead of the shock in the precursor, maybe you could do, get a direct indication of the interstellar, pre-existing interstellar medium field. Well, what I'm saying is that from the radio polarization, it's difficult to get the pre-existing unperturbed magnetic field.
But why would that field matter?
Well, because acceleration is going on over here and not over here. Observationally, that's...
Right, but if the field is not parallel at that shock, I mean, it's the same magnetic field that does synchrotron to an X-ray and in the radio, right? So if the field is not parallel at the shock, forget it, it's not a parallel shock.
Well, this is sort of an argument. What else could it be? What is the possible origin of this very nice symmetry where you see two polar caps being efficient accelerators? The most natural thing I can think of is that this is a uniform magnetic field, and these are the regions where the shock is most parallel. Maybe you can think of another explanation.
It could be that you get the preferential magnetic field amplification where it's parallel, actually. So once you make it turbulent, it's not parallel anymore. But that's the place where the amplification started. So it's a sort of bootstrapping.
Although I must say, I think in the northwest there is some radio emission. So already some X-rays started going on there as well. But the alternative would be that only in those streams you have high enough shock velocities. That would be an alternative.
But the point is there is...
But it's spherical. Look, so how can you say that the shock velocity is higher in one direction? It would be oblate by now.
What did you say?
I said there is no good enough polarization map to do that kind of study.
Very recently, very good measurement of radio polarization was made for 2006. And the new polarization measurement showed that the part where we see efficient CO2 emission, X-ray polarization is low, very low. But for the part where, like this, we don't see strong CO2 emission, polarization degree is very, very high.
Okay.
So,
in which direction? Which direction?
Polarization direction. I don't know, because I hear from Jack Hughes, who gave a seminar at SLAC, and so I don't remember the information about the polarization direction or something like that, but the degree of polarization is surprisingly high. I think almost 70%.
You're saying that there is no
non-thermal? So the lead of...
So now we just have to know which direction we're...
typically there's polarization. Typically it's small, but the residual polarization suggests, in most cases, you get radio that may have more radio here.
But what you're saying is the degree of polarization is high over here. Where you would, so this would be consistent with saying that here you have much less magnetic field turbulent amplification, and here you have much more amplification, but the field becomes turbulent, and therefore the degree of polarization is less.
So that would be their kind of interpretation of the data.
Probably, if you can make it, since we don't know what the direction polarization measured was, we can make a sit here and make a prediction. If we get a hold of Jack and find out that the polarization direction on the barrel sides, if you like, is radial and the field is more or less tangential, could be the naive thing to think was going on there.
But again, that would tell you, if this interpretation is right, that would tell you the direction, preferential direction of the turbulent B field, but doesn't tell you about the direction of the B field over here.
A few things. So we looked into this, of course, not with Jack Hughes data, but for a couple of other remnants. And you have to be very careful that you separate the forward shock from everything it has to do with the CB.
Mm-hmm.
Has to do with the what?
Discontinuity. Okay, because that is. That's where things get very much whirled around, and that reduces the polarization very well.
So if you have separated back loss, at least you know at your order shouldn't go through the contact discontinuity.
No, but the contact discontinuity can come to the accelerated particles. Right. That's the issue. So
the particles can only cross the CD by diffusion.
The CD comes to the particles. The CD is very is first of all unstable. It's not a nice clear surface, and the second thing is whenever you have strong particle acceleration, it's closer to the shock anyway.
Right.
That brings radial field, right?
That brings all kinds of fields. So if you have the RT instabilities, of course you may expect also quite a bit of radial field.
Yeah.
And then that's the old problem. You have to separate those two.
The question to you then is, did they separate?
For 2006, we can see the forward shock clearly. So I think for this particular object, we don't need to be worried about the contamination.
Well, I don't know the data. It depends on the angular resolution and all these things.
Yeah.
No.
10.06 is
too far south, so you may have to use the ATCA that doesn't have to be a regular resolution. That's one thing.
Yeah.
And then you also need to have sufficient signal to actually get statistics, so that may require that you smooth.
Then we should move on.
Yeah, in fact, so. One thing I wanted to point out to this connection is if you believe in this picture where you have little amplification here and much more magnetic field amplification here, you might also think that the synchrotron emission is brighter because of the B field and not because of the particles. So in this context, it's interesting to have also this picture where you see more directly the particles convolved with something that is more homogeneous than the magnetic field at least, and that you see that it's really these regions which are also more efficient particle accelerators and not just magnetic field amplifiers. I'm only about halfway through my talk. So I can go very quickly through the rest of it, or we could have a part two at some other meeting this week or next week, maybe. That depends on what the organizers think.
Yeah, we certainly can continue this.
Yeah, we should spend equal time on the shells.
Just to give you a feeling, the idea is that we have a number of shells and discussing electronic and aerodynamic and discussing. This will also give me a chance to also add something about super bubbles.
You can schedule shells off, yeah, for sure.
So shells and super bubbles, for example, at some time we'll discuss.
Super bubbles would be interesting.
So we close now.
That was